This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Podcart's Life is Like a Box of Records podcast. My name is Helena Rafai. Occasionally, we bring in special guests to talk about the songs that have soundtracked their lives so far. For rights reasons, music might be shorter than the original song. Original music is by Good Dog, aka Susan Bear. This week's guest is Neil Anderson. Neil has been working with Biffy Clyro since he was 18 and is now their tour manager. Neil is a man who lives and breathes music like many others, and his passion for Biffy is unrelenting and completely infectious. Neil Anderson, welcome to Podcart. Really appreciate you doing this, as I know how busy you are. For those that might not know you, please tell us who you are.
My name's Neil. I work as a tour manager, among other things, with Biffy Clyro. I've worked for Biffy I think I'm about 6 months shy of having worked for Biffy longer than I haven't worked for them. So that's to say, I've worked for them for more than half of my life. I started working with them when I was 18 or 19. I started off the first time I met them in Falkirk, in a small bar in Falkirk, that I was there to see a friend from school's band play, and Biffy were on the bill as well, and they just blew my fucking mind. They were amazing. So I kind of kept in touch with them. At the time, I worked in Missing Records, and the long gone Missing Records that was in Wellington Street in Glasgow. So I think on that night, I introduced myself to them and said, "You should really come and do an in-store in Missing." To which they said, "Oh, we're actually playing in Tower Records next week to launch the EP that they did in Electric Honey." So that immediately blew my fucking mind. Thought, holy shit, they're playing in Tower Records, they're not going to be interested in Missing. But anyway, I met them, started to do bits for them. I started doing things like their website, doing some merchandise designs, that then graduated to going out on tour with them and selling their t-shirts. And then after a couple of years, the tour manager that we had at the time went off to work. I think it was with Franz Ferdinand that he went off to work with. So I, being the only other person there, kind of graduated to being the tour manager. And I've kind of been there. I've been in that role ever since. And I'm kind of lucky enough that I kind of do other bits with the band as well. So I'm pretty much full Biffy or my kind of full-time job on and off tour. That's the long story short of my professional career with Biffy. There's been a couple of gaps in the years where we've taken a little bit of time off, and I've been asked to work with other bands, which I've taken up a couple of those offers. As a young person that had come into tour management, as a bit of an aside from working with Biffy, it was quite fun to be asked to do other bands, but I was always a bit arrogantly idealistic, saying, well, my thing is Biffy, and my thing is Biffy because I love them. I think they were my favorite band, as well as being people that are now incredibly dear to me. But I had this kind of arrogant, idealistic principle that I wouldn't work for bands that I didn't really love. So the crux of that is that, in a couple of the gaps that Biffy took, I worked for a couple of other bands. I worked for a band called the Guillemots a number of years ago, who I still rate incredibly highly. I could have easily picked one of Fife's songs for this. But the seven track thing honed it in slightly more. So I did some work with Guillemots. yeah, I just loved them. I thought they were amazing. I think they are an amazing band. And then about 5 years ago, we had a few months off with Biffy, and I got asked to do James, who were a band that I never, at the time, was too young for in the kind of early 90s. But when I first started getting into kind of music, age kind of, I guess, 12, 13, I would get records from the Cumbernauld Library. I would rent or hire and check out CDs from the Cumbernauld Public Library, and the James Greatest Hits was one of those things. So when I got asked if I was free to cover a handful of shows and then a kind of an arena tour with James, I did it because, yeah, I had a really fond memory of sitting in my mum and dad's house on the computer, on the computer doing what I did, which was to go to websites I liked and then open up the HTML source of those websites and look at it and think, right, how did they make this website and how can I rip off 80% of this code and adapt it to my own website? I've got really fond memories of doing that, listening to the James Greatest Hits CD. So yeah, so I did a bit of touring with James for a little while, just in between some Biffy periods, but predominantly Biffy has been the thing that I've kind of dedicated my adult life to, which I feel very lucky and grateful to have been able to do.
So part of the premise for this podcast is that it's a bit like Desert Island Discs, I guess. Yeah. We've asked you to pick 7 songs that have soundtracked your life so far. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I love everything that you've picked.
Awesome.
Yeah, we'll get on to probably my favourite later, but Weezer, the Blue Album. So why did you pick this song?
So I feel like Weezer were... So this song in particular, I could have probably leant on anything from the Blue Album, but this song, which is the third track on that record, the fairly wincingly titled The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, there's something about this track that just it sums up that album perfectly. It's even at the very start, the kind of stereotypically Weezer drum fill that opens it, and then really fuzzy heavy guitars with really prominent acoustic guitar picking over it. The whole thing is just, yeah, it encapsulates that record perfectly to me. I think of all the songs in that album, it's maybe the most distinctive sounding, which is, you know, saying something. But yeah, I love it. I really love it. There's just that song has something really special about it. Weezer were kind of my kind of gateway, if you like, from pop into kind of guitar music. Weezer and also Ash to a slightly lesser degree, because I got that first Ash record for about £3 on cassette in our price in Cumbernauld, which I think was a genius move by them to get people like me to buy their record. But yeah, Weezer, they were, like with a lot of people, the Windows 95 install CD had a copy of the video of Buddy Holly on it. And I think I was aware of them maybe prior to that. They'd maybe been on Top of the Pops or the staying up late to watch The Word. I think they'd maybe been on that. But there was something about being able to see their video on your home computer that really sort of, there was something quite magical about that. So yeah, so Weezer, I'm pretty sure I would have got the tape from the Cumbernauld Library, which I mentioned. And yeah, it was, it just blew my mind. Prior to that, you know, the first concert that I ever went to so this would have been 2 years prior to this, in 1992, was Take That at the SECC. My mum, my baby sister and I to see that. And that was amazing. Don't get me wrong, that I really love Take That. Take That's actually another band that I've done a brief bit of tour management with, which was quite exciting. And again, I did it for my younger self. I was asked to do it, and I kind of had to do it for my younger self. But yeah, we saw Take That. I loved pop music. I loved going to the supermarket and buying 7-inch singles from Asda for 99p. You know, just whatever was kind of whatever pop songs were on the radio. And I think at some point that shifted slightly towards bands like Ash, and then to Weezer. So yeah, I went from buying Chakademus and Pliers 7 inches to rent to getting the Blue album from the Cumberland Library, and it was just the perfect kind of bridge. I think I was a couple of years too young for Nirvana, so Weezer were kind of my, they were the band that kind of got me into guitar music, and they remain one of my favorite bands. You know, their first two records are, you know, amazing, undeniably amazing. They were the first band that I ever traveled a significant distance to see. My friends and I, in our first year of uni, traveled to San Diego to see Weezer, because it appeared that it might be their last tour and that they might be splitting up. So we spent the first installment of our student loan to fuck off to San Diego for three days to see them. And it turns out that they didn't split up. It turns out that we went to the show, we flew back, we landed into London, had a day to kill in London before getting the train back up to Glasgow. And pretty much the first thing that we saw when we got into London was an advert in the NME for a show at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, maybe 3 months later. So that was a bit of a fucker, having just travelled to San Diego to see them. They were and remain a really important band to me.
Did your image ever adapt or change to fit in with these musical influences?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, not instantly at the time, because I think for a long time, I was in kind of baggy jeans and skate shoes and sort of belt, you know, interesting belt buckles and tight t-shirts, that kind of prevailed over anything else. But I definitely got a couple of v-neck woolen jumpers and sort of pinstriped shirts to wear underneath them, and definitely got a couple of pairs of trousers that were slightly more that fitted slightly better. So yeah, it definitely came out in what I was wearing.
Moving on to your, we're going to pick up on your second record, out of your box, Benfolds 5, Evaporated. What I really like about the list that you've picked is there's some real dynamic shifts. So Benfolds 5, why did you pick this one?
So I think Benfolds is probably my Elton John, if you like. If Rivers Cuomo's my David Bowie, Benfold is kind of my Elton John. For some reason, his records have just stuck with me really strongly, and that no more so than Whatever and Every Amen, and the second Benfold's 5 records. So I first heard it, I worked in Missing Records on Wellington Street. I started working there illegally when I was 15 because I lied about my age. And I think they were looking for a kid that liked, you know, that wore baggy jeans and skate shoes and liked rock music. So I got a weekend job at Missing and was exposed to, you know, there's another band that are going to come up later on. Again, I heard in Missing for the first time. But yeah, Benfold's 5, this record, somebody put it on in the shop, and just right from the first song, I just didn't know what I was listening to. I wasn't used to hearing piano in music that I found interesting. I wasn't used to hearing, they're quite Weezer-y in their, you know, in their composition and their songs. It's really, really cool, interesting pop songs dressed up with, you know, with a piano and a really, really, really distorted, heavy, fuzzy bass. Way too late, feeling hungover and old. And the sun was shining bright, now I walk barefoot down the road. Started thinking about my old man. It seems that all men want to get into a car and go. It just didn't sound like anything else, and I think the going back to just having grown up listening to and loving the most obvious pop songs and pop music, it just really spoke to me, and the heaviness of it spoke to the to that side of my kind of musical interests. So yeah, that I put that record on quite a lot in missing whenever it would come round to be my turn to put something on the stereo. Kind of fell in love with it, and then went and got that, and got the first, went back and got the first album, and then got their third album, kind of just completely went down the rabbit hole with it. So this song in particular, I just really, I love how pretty it is. I love how kind of melodic and just lovely it is. It's the last track on that record, I think. And yeah, I just love it. I've got some really fond memories of involving this song as well. And my family are all, I guess, having been punished by me putting that record on a lot at home in the car. My mum and dad, my sister have all, you know, they all really like Ben Folds and Ben Folds 5 now as well. So I've got a couple of just lovely memories, both at the time and latterly. He played in Kelvingrove a few years ago, and I went with my sister, and my mum and dad came. A couple of the guys from the band, from Biffy, were there. One of my school friends were there. I think we were maybe the only people on the guest list, so they basically gave us the little kind of, there's a little area down near the front of the stage that get cordoned off. So it was just this beautiful experience of seeing him play in Kelvingrove Park with all my kind of family and loved ones around me, and it was just magic. And prior to that, Biffy played Tea in the Park. They headlined Tea in the Park. I think it was the last year or the second last year before the site moved, and then it eventually closed down. But we headlined on the Sunday. It was a really full-on hectic day. It had been a really full-on and hectic week. We played the show on the Sunday night and then went back to the hotel in Glasgow, and Ben Folds was playing the concert hall on Monday night. So my sister and I went along, and after what had been a really difficult week, it was just this gorgeous experience going into the concert hall and sitting with the lights out, watching Ben Folds on his own with the piano for about 2 hours, playing all these songs, including this song, and just sitting next to my sister, not really saying anything because I was just completely ruined from, I think, the week that ran up to it. And usually when I get home from tour, usually when we've been away, the last thing that I want to do is to go to see live music. But there was just something really special about it. It's one of my fondest concert-going memories, is that show, is sitting a few rows from the front with Amy, just being tired, but then the lights going out and suddenly it making total sense why I was there. There's probably going to be a lot of these songs that I talk about where I kind of pull fairly random, where they trigger fairly random associations. But another one with Ben Folds was when Biffy were recording their album Opposites in Santa Monica in Los Angeles, and we were at a studio called The Village Recorder. So we, Biffy, were in there for about 3 months. We kind of all had a house in Santa Monica that we lived in for two 3 month periods with a little break in the middle. So we were in one day, and Ben Folds walked past us in the foyer of the studio, and we were all a bit like, "Fuck, that's Ben Folds." And the studio assistant that was working with Biffy at the time knew him really well, knew that we were fans, and just did a really quick introduction. And he was just a really lovely, genuinely quite interested fellow. He was kind enough to deal with me asking him if he could do an autograph for my little sister. It was just a really, really nice, unexpected encounter with him.
The next pick is a band that is key to now, Biffy Clyro. I remember the first time I saw them was on MTV2 Questions and Answers, and I was bored. The song that you've picked, I'm quite surprised. I thought you'd maybe pick something earlier, but In the Name of the Wee Man.
Yeah, it was really hard. I procrastinated for quite a while on which Biffy track to pick, even where to place them in this kind of in this not quite chronological but certainly biographical list of songs. So I figured right in the middle, and I've picked a song that's really late in their career. It's almost one of the last things that they've recorded in terms of their discography. So, In the Name of the Wee Man. It was a track that when they had finished their recording their last album, Ellipsis, they had a few days off before mixing started on that record. So in having just spent 6 months, I think it was, studiously recording what became Ellipsis, they had a couple of days off and they thought, fuck it, let's go into another studio, just us and an engineer, and we're going to record, I think they recorded another 16 tracks that they had over the course of these 3 days, one of which was In the Name of the Wee Man. So that the track ended up being on the with records, obviously there's various versions of records now. You have the album and then you have to have certain extra tracks for digital providers for other countries. So The Name of the Wee Man was added to the end of the record on the kind of expanded edition. It closes the record on the kind of expanded edition, which I think the bands kind of consider to be the definitive version of that record. So it's the last thing on their last album. But I love the song dearly. They've played it for the last few years on tour, and it's such a moment in the set. It's kind of unlike anything else. Whilst I could have picked something from much earlier in their career, I feel like this song is a fairly good representation of all the sort of different sides of Biffy, the kind of mathy, intense, just mad, just frankly mad things that they do. It's got the kind of intensity and the heaviness. It's really quite poppy at points. And it's a really good example of the Simon Neil scream towards the end, which Simon has this way of screaming that it's just kind of unlike anything else. There's like a Mariah Carey kind of not flutter to it, not in terms of the pitch, but just in terms of if you looked at the waveform of his voice, I'm sure it would just be up and down and up and down. And this song, the last minute or so of this song, is a really, really great example of that. And I think Biffy, sometimes people who haven't seen them live or kind of forget that they're so heavy. They're so heavy, and I think their later albums have kind of shown how in control they've become of their abilities. There's songs, I think a couple of people on that have done this previously have picked the song There's No Such Thing as a Jaggy Snake, and I kind of liken this song a little bit to that. But whilst Jaggy Snake was three albums, it was kind of written in between their second and third album. And it's the sound of a band full of ideas. Band are barely holding on. And I feel like some of the ideas in Wee Man and some of the ideas that are on some of the songs in their new record, it's that same band that are just firmly in control of their madness. So yeah, it was really sticky trying to pick a song. I don't think it's possible to pick a song that sort of that in some way reflects every aspect of the band and every aspect of my relationship with them. But I think it felt right to pick something that was newer rather than later.
How many shows have you done with the band? Do you know?
Every show since the year 2002, I think. So I genuinely couldn't tell you. It could be 1,000. It could be a couple of thousand. I'm honestly not sure. I should look it up, or I should figure it out. Our pal Frank Turner has kept a studious list of every show that he's ever done, so he can go on stage and announce, "Hello, this welcome to show 2,346." I haven't kept a numbered list. I'm sure I could put it together. But I couldn't put a number on other than to say that it's pretty much every show since 2002.
And as their tour manager, and you're seeing literally thousands of shows, how does the experience compare from one show to the next? Does every time you see them live, you just remember, oh my God, this is why I do this?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. There's every single time they walk on stage, it's, you know, the first thing that I do when the band go on stage, so I'll go with them to the stage. We'll wait around, wait for a couple of minutes, and then wait for the stage to be ready. They'll go on stage. I'll finish doing what I was doing, whether that's, you know, putting jackets on chairs or whatever it is. And then the first thing I'll do is go straight out and try and get as far into the crowd as I can and watch as much of the first song or so that I can. Because it's still a fundamentally exciting thing to see them go on stage and to see the first song, to see the kind of reaction of the the crowds to the first song. And Biffy don't tend to ease into it. They tend to start big. So yeah, it's always kind of exciting. Some shows, just the nature of having been around them and seen so many times, I'm very sensitive to what the boys are doing on stage. So if any of them are having a bad show, or if there's anything kind of going on, I'm kind of acutely attuned to what's going on. Partly because obviously if there's something going wrong, it needs to be addressed, or just if any of the boys aren't in a particularly good headspace, I have to be quite attuned to what's going on. So I think some of the times my enjoyment of the show can sometimes be put to the side because I need to be attending to whatever needs to be attended to. But I don't think there's ever a single show where I don't have an emotional moment one way or another. There's been some shows some shows I found really difficult. There was a show about 18 months ago on the acoustic tour. We did this tour for an MTV Unplugged album that they did, and my uncle passed away on the first few days of the tour. His funeral was scheduled a week later, so we were in, I think we were in, we had a show in Birmingham, so the band and I got into, it had been obviously a really tough few days, and we got into the hotel, you know, at 3 a.m. the night before the show, having travelled across from the previous city. So I got into the hotel for a few hours and then got up at sort of 6 a.m, got the train up to Scotland for Andy's funeral, and then travelled back down to Birmingham after the funeral. And I was a bit delayed. The train was cancelled, so I ended up flying. And I got back to the venue maybe 5 minutes before they went on stage. So I kind of barrel into the backstage with a bag on my shoulder. They're all in their kind of show clothes, ready to go on. And that it was just to get back, having been able, I was so happy, or not happy, but I was so pleased and glad that I'd been able to get to my uncle's funeral. But it was really important to me to get back to my other family, and to be there with them. So seeing them just as they went on stage, getting kind of hugs and kisses from them all, and then watching them play that show, that was a really special show for me, because it had just been a really, really odd day. And I think that's kind of what I needed. I needed to get back to what felt like home, and to, yeah, just to see them play these songs that were so special to me. So whilst that was a really difficult day, the show, their show helped me immeasurably that evening. And yeah, there's been some, part of the joy with Biffy is that, having been there since day dot, like at this point, I'm the kind of, other than Simon, Ben and James, in all of our kind of extended crew and, you know, agents and label management, I'm kind of the one that's been there the longest now. So there's something really quite special and magical about seeing the kind of slow but steady progression that they've had, and feeling really like quite proud and sort of just lucky to have been part of that. You know, Biffy, like there's always been this sense, I think publicly there was maybe a sense that they took a really big jump in between their third and fourth record. That was Infinity Land and Puzzle, when the first record that they released with Warner. But really, in terms of the view from inside the car, from our perspective, it was always really steady. The venues never jumped massively. You know, the venue every large venue that we'd played, every venue that we was coming to headline, we had already been there supporting somebody. The first time that they headlined an arena, you know, we'd been in that space before. Everything seemed like it was happening steadily and gradually, and at a pace that was kind of manageable. And I think there was also a sense of them perennially being underdogs, whether or not that's because of their weird name, whether or not that was because, you know, even I guess a good example of this is when they got to the point where they could headline festivals. So they'd spent 10, 15 years playing every stage, playing every slot on the bill, and it got to the point where they could be the last ones to go on the main stage. So we did see the first time they headlined, and the only time they headlined Tina Park, because it closed a couple of years later. I forget the band, but there was a band on earlier on in the day who said, "Hey, is everybody looking forward to Biffy Cyro?" And it's like, they're fucking headlining and people still can't get the name right. There was the first time that they headlined the Reading Festival, again, having played every slot, every fucking stage on the way up. First time they headlined Reading Festival, the day of the, obviously Reading's in Reading and Leeds, so I think we did Leeds on the Friday, Reading on the Sunday. And the first fucking thing that we all hear on the day of the show, we all wake up to the fact that Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails has been tweeting, sort of kicking off at the fact that Biffy, who were headlining, and Nine Inch Nails, who were going on before them, he basically said, the band going on after us, whoever the fuck they are, have stitched us up on our production, which for a start wasn't true. We had nothing to do with Nine Inch Nails production. That was all through the festival. But regardless, they've got to the point where they can headline this festival, and yet there's still some fucking person who's trying to kind of put them in their place, trying to sort of point the big finger, saying that you shouldn't be where you are. So I think throughout all of it, there's just been this constant slight fight to it all, which I think has ultimately made it all more rewarding and has given everybody that slight thicker skin that's probably needed to kind of to prevail against things like that. Because whilst nobody's a mad fan of Nine Inch Nails, it's still a bit of a sting to wake up and for Trent Reznor to be taking his anger out on you. for something that's ultimately nothing to do with us. It's an internal communication breakdown between him and his own team. So yeah, that's the long way round of saying that, yeah, whilst Biffy have managed, have quite rightly got to a place where they can take advantage of these really big opportunities, it's never been as simple as, here you go, boys, take this and take it easily. There's always been a bit of a fight, there's always been a bit of a struggle, there's always been a bit of a kind of just trying to always be moving on, I guess.
A slight change of pace now. This, again, I was surprised to see. I don't know why a stereotype. It's terrible of me by now. But why did you pick Sarah Harman, this record in particular?
So I spent a year, aged 18 and 19, I spent a year in Toronto at uni. It was the first time I'd sort of lived away from home, very much in at the deep end, getting on a plane to Toronto and living there for a year. So when I got there, one of the first things that I did was went to a record store and sort of had a just poke around. And quite, I think pretty much immediately, one of the first things that I saw was a stand of Canadian artists. So I bought three or four things. I think it was maybe the first Stars EP record. It was certainly the first Broken Social Scene record. It was a band called Matthew Good Band, and it was You Are Here by Sarah Harmer, which I think is her second record. Just literally thinking, well, fuck it, I'm in Toronto. I've just come from Glasgow, where I worked in the record shop and was very aware of the local bands in and around Glasgow. So I'm going to do the same here. I'm going to figure out and get to know all these bands I've never heard of that are from here. And just this record, I just fell in love with it.
The night into the water, we push the boat from shore, breaking the air in the stillness of the bay. Intensity of stars reflected in the harbor, silently ignite. The ore dips into oil like water. We are away.
So she was the singer of a band called Weeping Tile, which I found out laterally it wasn't a band that I was aware of at the time. And then she released a number of solo records. I think she released five solo records, of which this is the second. I think this is her first proper studio record. I believe her first album was a sort of set of demos that she'd recorded at home. So I've never seen her live. I've never seen any mention of her playing live. I've never seen any evidence that she's ever come to Europe. I don't think I've ever seen any of her records in a record store in Europe, outside or certainly outside of Canada. But hearing this record and then hearing a song of hers that was played on the alternative Toronto radio station, I think it was called The Edge, there was just something about this album that I just fell in love with. So this album basically soundtracked the entire kind of year that I was in Toronto, and has continued to be a really comforting record that I'll go and put on since. It's just that her voice is great, but her songs are just fantastic. They're so brilliant. I love them. Again, very melodic, very poppy, quite folky. There's a spark there. There's a gem that makes her, that just sets her apart from things that would potentially sound like her to untrained ears. Joan Shelley, an American singer that Craig B from Motive Dust and Ex-Areogram, I saw him tweeting about her, and I've really gone down the rabbit hole with Joan Shelley, and her music reminds me a bit of Sarah Harmer, plaintive country leaning folky melodic just loveliness.
So you've put one of my favorite pieces of music of all time, and it's your next pick. the top line when it hits the 50-second mark, it just, the hairs on your arms. So entitled for Sigur Rós. I mean, I hear on the grapevine this is one of your favourite bands.
Yeah, very much so. Again, so I working in the record shop in Glasgow, somebody put on their first album. I'm not going to do them the disservice of trying to say the titles of their songs, because I'll just make an absolute fool of myself, but I'm fairly confident I can allude to them, you'll know what I mean. But yeah, the first, heard their first record, it, whilst it blew me away, it, you know, I loved it, but it wasn't a record. I didn't listen to it exclusively for a year or anything like that. You know, it was a record that I really loved, but it was obviously so kind of unique that it kind of occupied its own special little place. And then I forget the gap between the two records. It was maybe 2 or 3 years, but the longer that I lived with that first album, in fact, it's actually their second album, the blue album with the little alien fetus on the cover. I'm referring to it as their first record. I think it's actually technically their second record. But anyway, between that and between the third album, which was the Brackets, the untitled album, there was a good couple of years, I think. And in that period, my kind of love for them really cemented itself. So that album, yeah, I saw them at the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh between those two records. And they played, whilst I don't remember necessarily them playing this song, I remember them playing new music at that show that wasn't on that second record and being blown away by it. And I think that sort of deepened my, kind of love for them. So fast forward to, I think it's January 2002, and I'm in Toronto and the movie Vanilla Sky is released. So I think I was probably, you know, 18, 19-year-old boy, young man. I went to see that film. I think I saw it at the cinema. I forget whether or not I knew before. I think I knew beforehand. I think I'd seen online that there was Sigur Rós were on the soundtrack and that there was a new Sigur Rós track on it somewhere. So I went to see it, I think, knowing that, and the movie, I really loved the movie. The movie really kind of moved me. I've gone back to it since, and it potentially doesn't hold up quite as well as it did at the time. But at the time, I just, Vanilla Sky, I really loved the film, and a real key of that was the soundtrack, the whole thing. I know it's supposed to feel like a bit of a dream, but it felt like a dream. It felt like a long music video. And I think the soundtrack, Jeff Buckley was on it. There's my favorite Red House Painters song, Have You Forgotten, is on there. The first track on Kid A is on there. I think that maybe opens it. The soundtrack's quite remarkable for that album. Watching with my kind of one memory of watching the film that does kind of crystallize is watching the movie and hearing the song from the Blue Alien album, Sven for Englar. I'm butchering the pronunciation of that, but hearing that song on the soundtrack and thinking, oh, cool, right, there's Sigur Rós, but obviously the new song isn't on here. That must have been nonsense. And then the movie, right at the end of the movie, this song, Untitled 4. Version on the movie soundtrack is a live version of the song because the album didn't come out until October of that year, sort of 9 months later. But yeah, right at the end, having kind of written off the fact that I wasn't going to hear a new Sigur Rós song, and then lo and behold, it's there. I've got a memory of that being really special, and I think the song plays as he jumps off the roof at the end of the movie. So yeah, so whilst the movie, I love the movie. I've gone back to it. It's not quite as special as I maybe thought it was at the time, but that band were and became massively important to me in my life. So again, with a lot of all of this stuff, I've spent most of my life with, you know, the guys and Biffy, and I've got a couple of really fond memories of experience. You know, as I said, I saw them at the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh, and then I went to see them at the Barrowland in Glasgow, and then I didn't see them for quite a while after that. There maybe a few years that I just wasn't at home when they played in Glasgow. We didn't see them at festivals until, you know, years later. And we were again in California, the boys were recording Opposites, and Sigur Rós played at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery in Hollywood. So we all went. So the three members of the band, Simon's wife Francesca, and I went along to this show at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and it was the sun was setting and they played, and it was fucking incredible. It's one of the best shows I've ever seen. And you know, part of that was the sort of the freedom of being in California with my, you know, closest friends, seeing a band that I loved with them. It was just magic.
Changing the dynamic and returning to Canada, Arcade Fire and Wake Up. So why this?
So I'd got the Arcade Fire EP, the first EP I had got from the, you know, owing to the Canadian connection, owing to kind of keeping in touch with people there and wanting to know what Canadian bands were happening. So I'd got that, somebody had sent me that EP in the post, which I had to go to the post office and pay about fucking £9 on customs charges to actually receive, but got the EP, really, really loved it. Whilst I thought the EP was amazing, it wasn't like, shit, these guys are going to be really important to me. But then a year, 6 months later, Biffy were still on Beggar's Banquet. We were in London doing some press, and I think it was Ruth, who was the radio plugger at Beggar's, we'd got into the habit whereby she would give me lots of interesting CDs. She gave me the second Interpol record a few months before it came out. She gave me a bunch of other things kind of before they came out. So we had this dynamic whereby she would slip me copies of records that she thought I'd liked. And she gave me the Funeral. She gave me a kind of advanced CD of Funeral, which I've still got kicking around somewhere, kind of months before it came out. And yeah, it was amazing. It was the EP kind of perfected, which is wild because I read somewhere that it only cost them $10,000 Canadian, which is about $6,000 in British pounds at the time to record. It sounds fucking amazing. So that, hearing that record really cemented it for me. So I then saw them at the Debating Chamber in Glasgow University Union, the one at the far end of Queen Margaret Drive, not the QMU, the other one, the one down. They played the Debating Chamber in there. So I saw them with a friend in there, and it was fucking amazing. So 300 people. They came in, they started the show from walking from the back of the room through to the stage, played the show, left the stage through the audience, the whole, which today is obviously, it's a wee bit overdone. You know, everybody and their aunties kind of done that now, but at the time it felt genuinely remarkable. It was like, oh, fucking hell, oh my God, they're behind us. And that show was amazing. I feel like at that show they played songs from Neon Bible, despite this being about 2 years before Neon Bible came out. I think they played No Cars Go and maybe Crown of Love. And then seeing them at the Barland 6 months or 9 months later. And then, the Barland would have been a couple of years later. So late after they played the University Union, Biffy were doing a summer of festivals. So this would have been 2005. So Biffy were playing, if Biffy were playing a festival, we were waking up and playing very early on. They were playing very early on. So I think at Reading Festival, we'd played kind of midday or something like that on the main stage. And Arcade Fire were playing in the tent, and they were playing at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So we did, Biffy played their show, and then Simon from Biffy and I sort of hightailed it across the site, because we were like, we'd both gone down the rabbit hole. I think I've used that phrase a few times, but we'd both properly dialed into that record, into Funeral. We were kind of in love with it, and they were a really, really exciting band for us. So we finished the Biffy show, and Simon and I belted it over to the Radio 1 stage. We got there, I feel like we got there about an hour and a half before their show, because we just presumed that every fucking band on the site would be going to that show to get onto the side of the stage to watch that band play. So we thought we should get there early doors. And as it turned out, I think we were the only people on the side of the stage watching them play. But it was just incredible.
Throughout, there's obviously you've got such a passion for music, and you have done since you were young, quite clearly. And within an instant, it feels already that we're on to the last song. And
I know, right?
Yeah, and a band that I know is very, very special to the Biffy camp, and Frightened Rabbit and the Oil Slick.
So, I've got a sort of really massive records collection. I've bought CDs and records since I started listening to music, but I do also listen to a lot of streaming stuff as well, just for the East. And I got an email from Spotify a couple of years ago, and the statistic for how much I'd listened to Frightened Rabbit was just wild. I hadn't quite realised how much I had. Sort of just how much I'd listened and how much their music had sort of bedded into being just a part of my life, a part of my kind of day to day. This song, The Oil Slick, it's the last song on their fourth record, Pedestrian Verse, which is also my favourite of their albums. I think I said before, I don't initially go into songs because of their lyrics, but Scott's songs are potentially the exception to that. I think his lyrics and his handle of verses is kind of like nobody else. I'm always really dubious when singers or songwriters release their lyrics as a book, as if their songs are somehow poems, and I don't think that's quite right. I think songs and lyrics kind of are, you know, exist, and their reference to the music's kind of critical. I don't think collections of song lyrics can necessarily be presented as poetry, but again, I think Scott's songs are potentially the exception to that, and this one's certainly. Frightened Rabbit are a massively important band to me and to the guys. We first heard of them, I think, through the guys in Area Gram, who had toured with the Twilight Sad. So we'd heard about the Twilight Sad through the Gram guys, and then accordingly Frightened Rabbit from that. We, I guess the year Midnight Organ Fight came out, back when people would release singles on vinyl and CD, we had a single out, I forget which one it was, but we were doing in-stores in HMVs and FOPs up and down the country, where we would pitch up to the shop at 2 in the afternoon. The boys would play a short set, and then they would sign copies of the single for a few hundred people. And the coolest thing about it was that afterwards, the shop would tend to allow us to grab a bundle, a handful of things each, and take off with them. So Simon had picked up the Midnight Organ Fight. He'd kind of, Simon's very much ahead of most folk when it comes to hearing back here being on bands. So he was aware of them. He'd picked up the Midnight Organ Fight, and we'd later that evening we all got on a plane to go somewhere. And I've got this memory, again, a vivid memory of being sat down on the plane being kind of ready, you know, everyone sat down, nobody's standing, seatbelts on, it's getting ready to taxi. And suddenly Simon's head a few rows in front of me kind of pops up, kind of like a meerkat, and he turns around, catches my eye, and his eyes are wide. And I forget whether he actually said it or whether he just held up the CD and motions to it, but the message was clear. It was that this record is something else. So yeah, I got it. I fell in love with it immediately. I feel like I bought everything that they'd ever released. I feel like I emailed Fat Cat and said, "Do you have copies of this, this, and that?" Because I kind of want to get all of it. And later, it would have been later that year or the following year, we asked them to come out on tour with us. At the time, it was the biggest tour that Biffy had done. It was the first time they had headlined Brixton Academy in London and the first time they headlined the SECC in Glasgow. So Frightened Rabbit came out on tour with us. They were lovely. We got to know them. They were lovely, lovely fellas, lovely boys. And those songs were just fucking unreal. I think on day one, or maybe the first time that we met them, I feel like I remember asking them if they would, was it me or maybe Simon? One of us asked them if they were going to be playing the song Heads Roll Off from Midnight Organ Fight, to which they laughed and scoffed and said, "No, because it's fucking rubbish." Which none of us obviously agreed with, and I suspect that they've come around on it since. But that's a kind of that memory sticks out as very early on in our kind of in our meeting up with them. And yeah, we did those shows. They were great. I feel like they went down really well, especially even in the big stage in the SEC. On the last night of the tour, our band and crew we'd basically booked every room in the Brunswick Hotel in the Merchant City. We had a big party there afterwards. And they all, again, I remember my sister pitching up in a taxi with half a Frightened Rabbit to an after show that I was leaving, and thinking, fucking hell, these guys know how to go at it. And yeah, that album just stuck with us. And then, yeah, they continued to release music. They released their third album, Winter Mixed Drinks, which was magic. And then they released Pedestrian Verse, their fourth record, which, whilst I think all their albums are amazing, I feel like Pedestrian Verse is maybe the fully formed Frightened Rabbit. Amazing. The songs are just towering. They're remarkably good. And yeah, Scott's turn of phrase had been absolutely perfected, I think, at that point. I think that's maybe what the album title is maybe in reference to as well. So that album was massively important to us, to all of us. And for me, this song, which is the last track on the record, it's just amazing. It's got this sort of weirdness of their earlier work with the kind of confident melody of their kind of latter albums. And again, like I said earlier, lyrics aren't necessarily something that I tuned into, but we've still got hope, so I think we'll be fine in these disastrous times is a line that I think couldn't be more pertinent for kind of right now. And it's a line that every time I hear it, I get a goosebump, I get a bit of a shiver. I think it's probably the, for somebody who hit his pinnacle of songwriting so many times, I think it is definitely has to be up there for it. And a big part of it as well is just the really, we just have, well, whilst we didn't necessarily get to spend as much time with the Frightened Rabbit Boys over the years as we would have wanted to, just different touring schedules, we only toured together that once. There were little moments where they would kind of come in and out of our thing, which were really special. Like the last time Biffy headlined at the O2 Arena, I think Frightened Rabbit had been in London the day before or the day after, but they got in touch because they were trying to find somewhere to park their tour bus for a day off. So we kind of parked them up at the O2 on the day of our show. I think we gave them a dressing room in the backstage and just kind of let them be there for the day. And, you know, they weren't part of the show. They were just kind of in town. And it was just lovely. Like, you know, that day was mad as you know, the quote unquote, the big London show tends to be. But I have a really pleasant memory of after the show with all the after show revelries going on of some of the Frightened Rabbit Boys kind of strolling down the corridor, having been to the after show and just hanging out. And it was just lovely just knowing that they were kind of in, not just at the show, but actually, you know, backstage with the dressing room with their bus parked out the back. Yeah. And then, so yeah. And obviously Scott passed away, which I won't dwell on too much. But when Scott passed away, we had obviously all known in the days beforehand that he was missing. The day that we found out, I'd slept in, I woke up and saw that there was a text waiting on my phone from my sister. And then before I could look at that, the phone rang and it was Simon from Biffy. And we talked about it and kind of consoled each other. And since the Biffy guys and I have always kind of, we've always been very close, and being on tour with each other whilst sometimes we get upset, and the reason we're upset is because of one of the other guys. That's just the nature of people being around each other. I think nearly every single time when one of us is in a bad way mentally and speaking on tour, the only way that we're brought out of it is with the help of the others. And that, so, you know, Simon, James and Ben and I are very close, and they have certainly helped me out of the hole on many an occasion. I hope that I've helped, and I think I have helped them too, and we've helped each other. But the Scott thing whilst we obviously were grieving our friend and grieving somebody that we cared about, and also grieving for the other guys in his band, knowing what it would be like if we lost one of our guys, I feel like we all came together after that a bit more as well, even between me and the boys, but also between the band themselves. I think it held a mirror slightly to the fact that the mental holes you can find yourself in, you need help to get out of them. With the best will in the world, it's always going to be easier if you've got help to climb out of them. The situation gave us all a moment for pause for sure. As I say, that band were really important to us. And this song, I think, is maybe more than any of the other songs. I put this in playlists. I come back to it often. I think it's just an amazing song. I think they were an amazing band. It seemed like the appropriate song as well to put as my seventh song, because it felt, of all of the songs there, it felt like it was the most prescient for where we are right now. As I say, on tour, we spend a lot of time together, and we've learned ways over years of touring. We've learned ways to try and keep our heads straight. We've learned that it doesn't do us any good to go out for massively long periods of touring without any breaks. We've learned the hard way that, you know, we need to have things a bit more structured, even just in how the boys now and how our day-to-day stuff is on tour. It just gave us, I think, the fright we needed to be able to take constant and ongoing steps to keep ourselves afloat, to keep our heads clear, and to enable ourselves to be honest with each other about how we're feeling. When I look back on the kind of early days of our touring, you know, we were all so close, and we were all sharing three people to a travel lodge room, and, you know, being in vans all the time. We spent so much time together, and I feel like we talked about everything other than how we were necessarily feeling ourselves. And I think that's no longer the case. I think everybody, certainly in the band and I, will sometimes do our own thing and not travel as part of the greater touring party. And even just little bits like that, I feel like we've done that to enable ourselves to feel more connected with each other, and to feel safe and happy and content in what can be a really stressful day-to-day situation, you know, whether it's because there's a big show, or whether it's because you've got three flights to catch, or, you know, 6 a.m. radio sessions. There's all manner of first world problems that we go through in what we do, but regardless of how comfortable the problem is, the effect on your mental health can still be the same. It can still be absolutely devastating and absolutely punishing. Over the course of things, keeping each other up and keeping each other in a positive place has become quite important. I certainly don't mean to conflate and associate my kind of love of Frightened Rabbit and my love of that song with that. But yeah, it can't help but inform when something like that happens. You can't help but reflect, I guess, on your own situation. That band have been very dear to me.
Neil, what an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being so candid as well.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.